Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com. Author of the Week on Radio Gorgeous.
Emily Hurricane is a renowned Irish journalist. She was editor of Himself magazine, then edited the Dubliner magazine. For the last 10 years, she's been a regular writer on the island's Sunday Independent newspaper. Her first book was a memoir, How to Really Be a Mother, in brackets. But today, we're talking about her first novel, The Privileged. Hi, Emily. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. First of all, you are the best writer I've ever read that can write a good crack, or as they say in Ireland, or party in England. There's a hell of a lot of raves, balls, discos, clubbing, and even lunch parties in Knightsbridge in your book. How come? I love it.
Well, there are a lot of parties, and I did, I mean, at a certain stage as I was writing it, I thought to myself, are there too many parties? But then I thought back to that stage of life, the late teens, the early 20s, and it seems to me, I mean, in retrospect, that is what it feels like, a whole lot of parties. I think one is just really dedicated to going to parties, talking about parties, looking forward to parties at that age. I mean, these do not mean as much to me anymore, and I don't go to very many of them. But, you know, at that stage of life that my characters are in the book, there were a lot of parties, and the parties always seemed to provide something. There was always a thing that happened. You know, there was gossip, there was stories that began and ended. An awful lot of what we went through seemed to happen at parties.
Yeah, the drama, the intrigue, the, you know.
Yeah.
So the line on the front cover of The Privileged says, they had everything, but sometimes everything is not enough. What does that mean?
So the book is about, it's essentially a book about friendship. And it begins here and now with two out of three friends. So the three of them, Amanda, Stella and Laura, have known each other since they were about 14 years old. They met at boarding school, and Amanda was the most fascinating girl in their class. She was the beautiful one. She was the one whose parents had lots of money. She was the one who was invited to all the parties, and the other two just kind of tagged along. They form what is at first an unlikely friendship, because Laura and Stella aren't really from the same kind of fabulous milieu that Amanda seems to inhabit so effortlessly. You know, they're just ordinary kids, but they end up, a strange quirk of fate puts the three of them into each other's lives, and they form this really, really strong friendship, which lasts through all the years of school and college and thereafter. And then the friendship begins to dissipate. It starts to crumble. Stella is in New York working as a lawyer for one of those big American law firms. Laura's a journalist, desperately trying to make a career for herself in Dublin. And Amanda has kind of disappeared off their radar. She has been increasingly troubled in her life in the years since college. And at the beginning of the novel, she has disappeared. And it is the idea that Laura and Stella need to get together and kind of look at their shared lives and work out what's gone wrong with Amanda and see if there's anything that they can do to put it right. And the idea of everything, I mean, Amanda is one of those girls who looks as if she had everything. She's stunningly beautiful, even when she's 14, when most of us look, you know, awkward at best. And, you know, she has, there's a lot of money behind her. Her parents are determined that she will do very well in life. She's bright, she's popular, she's clever and funny. She really does seem to have everything. And yet her life goes very, very spectacularly wrong. And so the idea, obviously, is that, you know, I mean, you can have what looks like everything and you can still be deeply unhappy. And so that's essentially the tagline in the book. And the book starts then with this mission that Stella and Laura have to find Amanda and to look honestly at all the years between them and to work out where their own lives have gone wrong and where Amanda's life has gone very badly wrong.
I must say, it was the biggest page turner I've read this year. I honestly couldn't put it down. It's one of those books
That's lovely to hear.
You can relate to it, you know. These are women that I you know, they're like me, they're like you. I mean, they are, they probably are you. I mean, we are.
Well, I guess. I mean, I suppose all of them are to some extent.
I went to your launch party and I met a friend there of yours. I didn't know you at the launch party. I was invited as a guest. And my friend said, your friend said, I'm really excited about reading it because I'm sure there'll be some stories from, you know, Emily's background that have got in there. I mean, has that happened?
I mean, you know, it isn't. And I suppose all writers say the same thing. They say there is no character who is any one person. And they're not. I mean, every character is a composite of different people I've known. And there is a fair amount of me in Stella and Laura, rather more so than Amanda. And there are lots of kind of bits of people that I've met over the years and bits of parties and scenes all kind of mixed up together. You know, I don't know if there are any specific episodes that are drawn wholesale from my life. I think you have to kind of disguise things. I think you have to change things. Otherwise, it's just another memoir. You know, the fact, the act of it being fiction means that you need to use your imagination to embellish things. But certainly it is drawn on the kind of life that I had. And
so did you go to a girls' boarding school?
No, I didn't actually. No. I went to the European school in Brussels.
But that's, that's still an international school, isn't it? You're meeting people from all different backgrounds, all different levels.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. I mean, it was a great fun school to go to. You know, you had the Italian section, the French section, the German section. It was really good fun. And, you know, we had a lot of freedom. It was not, you know, it wasn't a very restrictive school at all. They basically just, you know, let us all get on with it. And it was co-ed rather than an all-girls school.
Fabulous.
But, you know, that kind of early teenage life, the intensity of it is something that I think crosses, you know, regardless of what school you were at. It's very much the same. The way you forge those friendships when you are maybe 14, 15, 13 years old, and they are, in a funny way, they're more intense than anything that you ever go through again. I think, I mean, it's, you know, it's biological, it's hormonal, it is just the stage of life that you're going through. Everything feels so intense. I mean, remember, you know, everything, you felt that you would just die because it was so amazing or so terrible. There was no moderation to anything.
Yeah,
and
very
the same
extreme.
With friendship,
yeah,
this,
yeah.
You know, this idea you die for each other. You know, I mean, I certainly meant it at the time.
No, that's what I want to talk about, loyalty, because obviously loyalty is a massive subject in the book.
Yes.
And then halfway through the book, one of the characters bumps into a guy called Sean, and he says, haven't, you know, because they're all being very, very loyal to Amanda, she keeps letting them down. And he says, haven't you heard of something called blind loyalty? And I want you to explain what blind loyalty is.
Well, I mean, that is where you make the choice that you stick by somebody no matter what they do, that you don't judge your response by their actions, that you have actually decided that this person is in your life and that you will do, you'll stand by them no matter how badly they behave. And it is, it's a trait that I think is really very, I think it's really attractive trait. I just don't know. I mean, it's not a sensible one. You know, sometimes the sensible thing to do is just cut and run. You know, that somebody's life becomes increasingly at odds with yours, that the friendship can't be sustained without you making like a tremendous effort that will cost you something, you know, whether it costs you time or other friendships or, you know, other relationships, it will cost you something. And that maybe the thing to do is simply walk away, except that blind loyalty dictates that you can't and you won't. That you do stick by it. So it may not be sensible. It's a really visceral kind of a thing. It's a gut thing. And I think it is very attractive, even though, and in the book I say this as well, even though sometimes it's, you know, it's the stupid thing to do.
It is, but we've all done it. We've done it, particularly things like our first boyfriends that our mothers didn't approve of, and, you know, and
oh,
you just,
absolutely.
You know.
And again, I think it's kind of a feature of those kind of early years. I think we get a lot maybe more critical as we grow up and possibly more demanding of our relationships and our friendships. I think that maybe we aren't as willing when we're older to put up with, you know, what is difficult behaviour and if not outright bad behavior, you know, you kind of go, no, there is a line, this person has crossed it, and therefore I now feel that I no longer can have a relationship with them. But when you're younger, you don't think those things.
No, you don't. You just throw yourself in.
Your boyfriend does appalling things, and you stick right by them.
You do. Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous.
Now, as well, the book Privileged is about three women, but I also realise that it's actually quite a lot about mothers. Did you do that consciously?
I didn't do it purposely, but you're absolutely right that that is how it worked out. I mean, some of the strongest relationships in the book are not the romantic ones. They are the friends, the relationships between these three friends. But the second strongest relationships are between the girls and their mothers. That's definitely true. I didn't set out to do it deliberately, but it just, it happened, and it seemed the only way for it to happen.
I'm interested to know about your relationship with your mother.
Well, I mean, that is a very good question. I mean, I adore my mother. I think that she is an amazing woman. I'm lucky that she's still alive. My father isn't. So I guess I know how hard it is to lose a parent, and therefore I know how lucky I am to still have a parent. And, you know, I absolutely adore my mother. She is not an easy person. She is quite a demanding person. But I admire her hugely. I think that she is one of the most spectacularly bright people who I know. And what I love about her is that her reaction to everything is her own reaction. I've never heard her, you know the way. So, I mean, I'm totally.
She's got an original mind.
Original, completely. Yeah. I mean, I often just kind of say, you know, what do you think about something? Oh, well, you know, and I'll just say something I've heard somebody else say. You know, I'll parrot what is more or less the received view on this particular thing. My mother never does it, which means that she sometimes does the most outrageous things, but they are hers, you know, they are her own. And she does, as I say, she has a ferociously original mind. She's also, I mean, you know, she is, she's somebody whose good opinion I value, because it is not that easily given, which makes her sound like one of those horrible withholding kind of parents. She isn't, but she has very high standards for herself. And
yes, I was going to say, has she been, because, you know, from the book, Amanda's mother's quite demanding. You know what I mean? I'm just wondering whether your mother was demanding of you.
Yeah, definitely. In a way that I like, because it is predicated on the idea that she believes that I'm capable of really great things, which I think is lovely of her. Yeah. And therefore, if what I do isn't good, then her disappointment is such that she can't hide it. And, you know, I will always know if she really thinks something that I've written is any good. She's a terrible liar. And, you know, by and large, she just simply won't mention.
So I'm dying to know what she thinks of The Privileged.
She actually really likes it. I mean, I begged her not to read it because, as you know, there are some sex scenes in it.
Yeah, in fact, they're very good. I enjoyed your sex scenes. They were good.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. That's good. I always wondered, you know, you wonder.
Yeah,
you
yeah. They didn't make me go, ugh. You know?
I mean, great. That is, as a friend of mine said, she read a very early draft. She said, good. She said, the sex scenes aren't at all creepy.
That's exactly.
I thought was very, you know, that's kind of what you want. Yeah. But I mean, even though, God, I mean, my mother, I'm probably even far more of a prude than she is. But
no, but to share your mother, because you're opening up a side of you that you don't expose to your mother, you know.
No, I mean, you know. Exactly. And so it's kind of, you're a bit cringy about it.
Yeah, you know, you'd probably be scared when your daughter's 14 or 15 and reads it. You know what I mean?
Oh, God, I mean, absolutely. I think she probably shouldn't until she's 20 anyway. No matter how fast they're going these days. But no, my mother did read it, and I didn't know she was reading it, which was much better.
Yeah, much better.
That I wasn't kind of, you know, sweating blood. And no, she said she thought it was very well written. And that, you know, that made me happy. I figured that she couldn't and wouldn't have said it otherwise.
Now, another incredible thing that's happened in your life is you wrote the book and then you found out you had cancer.
I know, God.
Can you tell me about that? I can't. And
I mean,
you're still here, so.
What
happened?
Well, I got, I had a funny lump about this time last year. Mm. I started feeling a funny little lump at the back of my throat, a kind of roundabout where your tonsils are. And it was just kind of bothersome, small and annoying. I used to first, at the beginning, I only felt it when I was exercising. So when I was running and breathing heavily, I would notice, and it was a bit annoying. And then I began to notice it far more. And it just annoyed me. It didn't hurt. It didn't stop me eating, or it didn't make swallowing difficult or anything. But it was irritating. And eventually, when it had been there for about a month, I went to the GP, and the GP kind of said, oh, you know, well, you've got a swollen thyroid, and sent me off. I kind of went around the houses a bit. I went to see the wrong doctors. I went to an endocrinologist, and I had an ultrasound, and, you know, it was fine, everything's fine, everything's fine. And I was there going, I still have a lump, have a lump. So eventually I was sent to the right doctor after, I suppose, I don't know, maybe another couple of months. So it was November then when I went to see.
Oh, my God.
So a whole summer basically of the lump and nothing happening about it, and me being kind of, you know, but I mean, never, nothing ever made me think that it was going to be cancer. I mean, that was the last thought on my mind. I'm really healthy. I'm really, you know, I eat really well. I don't smoke. I barely drink. You know, I mean, all the things you're supposed to do, I do them. And I don't do the things that you're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I saw the right doctor, and he said, okay, I need a better look at it. And he put me under general anesthetic, and I came around and he said, that's a tumor and it's malignant. And I've got cancer. And he said, yes. And that was November the 16th last year. I mean, you never think you're going to hear that word. It's a horrible word. Yes. It's an awful thing to be
terrified. So how did, what happened? Did he give you an operation immediately and whip it out, or?
No, he didn't. Thank God. I mean, my fear then was that he was going to operate and that I'd lose my voice and, you know, half my tongue.
Oh, what? Because it was on your vote. Tell us where it was. Was it on your vocal?
So it was the base of the tongue.
Oh, my
and
God.
I thought it was pretty much inoperable, in that it was so far back. He would have had to remove about half my tongue in order to get to it.
Well, and you couldn't speak. And he literally said you wouldn't be able to speak if you did it.
Well, I mean, these were all the fears. And there was a possibility of, you know, a strong possibility of it. So very quickly, he said, we won't do surgery. And then he said, look, we don't really do surgery for this kind of cancer anymore. Because the weird thing about it is that it's a viral cancer. So most cancers, or most mouth cancers, caused by excessive drinking and smoking. And I mean, Alex Higgins died of mouth cancer.
He was
a perfect candidate for it. Because you know, that was his lifestyle. What I had was caused by the HPV virus, which is a very common virus. I have been told that about 80% of the population has it, and sometimes it mutates. It causes cervical cancer, and it also causes mouth cancer. I know, weirdly, I mean, I think women generally are more likely to get cervical cancer. Weirdly, I got the mouth cancer.
So how did they get rid of it? Was it through radiation?
It was a combination of radiotherapy and it was going to be chemotherapy, but in the end they actually gave me one of the newer kind of immunotherapy drugs, something called cetuximab, which is, it's less toxic.
That's fantastic. So you literally found the best people. You didn't have to have surgery. You know, I know it's awful you had it, but it's, thank God it's 2016 or whatever.
Yeah, God, I know. No, absolutely. Thank God. I mean, 2011, 2012, they probably would have done surgery and I would have had a different treatment. And, I mean, it was hell. It was awful. It was 7 weeks of a complete and utter nightmare, at the end of which, you know, I was being fed through a tube up my nose.
God, Emily.
You know,
poor
I had third-degree burns on my neck. Really, I was in rag order by the end of it, totally wiped out. But the cancer is now completely gone. It's very unlikely to come back, which is the brilliant thing.
Fantastic.
And, you know, and now I feel great. I mean,
I really want to ask you, because obviously, you know, you do think about life and death at that point. Has it changed your view of life?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I would always have said it hasn't changed my view of my lifestyle. It's not like I feel, you know, that I need to live my life in a materially different way. I was very happy with my life before. You know, I always have been. So I haven't made big changes, but it has showed me what we all know and we all forget, which is that life is very short and very precious. And you just realize that so much more when, you know, your health is removed from you. And when you feel miserable all the time, you realize what an immense boon it is to not feel miserable. You know, so I still have the feeling, I still wake up every day and I am so happy that I feel so well. You know, that, I mean, I have three children. I'm so happy that I have the energy to do things with them, you know, to talk to them, to be part of their lives in a way I wasn't for the, you know, the 7 or 8 weeks that I felt really, really bad. You know, just that it is amazing to be alive, to be well, to be out, to be about, to be able to do things. And that we are so lucky, all of us, that we can do it. And all the stuff we get in the stew about and worry about and sweat about, mostly it doesn't really mean anything in comparison with the fundamental joy of being well and being alive.
Thank you so much for telling us this on Radio Gorgeous. I think we need to get you on every day telling people. You can go around giving like positive talking. Honestly, it's really...
My friends, you know, my poor friends don't dare voice a single complaint anymore. You know, for fear they'll get my spiel about, you are so lucky. You are well. Your children are well. Stop fussing over the whatever it
exactly,
is.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, that really, I'm sure I'm a pain in the neck, but I profoundly feel it.
Fabulous. So lastly, why should I go out or Radio Gorgeous listeners go out and buy The Privileged?
Because I think you will really enjoy it. I think, and I do believe that it is what I set out to do. I wanted to write a book that would be hugely readable. You know, a really compulsive page turner that would be immensely enjoyable to read, but also that would be written in a way that is not dumb. You know, a way that is, I hope, smart and wise and, you know, has something to tell us about.
And it's got glamour in it. It's not all worthy. You know, you've got your designer labels mentioned. You've got the fabulous houses. You've got the posh set.
Absolutely.
You've got the,
there's
glamour all the way through, Emily. And that is so perfect. And it made me so happy.
That you like it. I really did. I mean, that just makes me incredibly happy.
No, I really recommend it. So Emily Hurricane, I'm going to call you, the way you live your life. I'm really impressed. Okay, thanks for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. The Privilege is published by Hatchet Books Ireland and it's available everywhere, including Amazon. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much for having me. Wonderful.
Radio Gorgeous, the place to find authors.